that's like probably one of their best like chemistry moments in this whole thing. And it's great to actually see Jane like kind of flexing what she does have. She's like, look, I'm not pretty, supposedly, and also I don't have wealth or stature, but at least I got an education, you dumb bitch.
Which is what she's doing in her head the whole time. She's like, oh my god, you're so dumb. I can't even be in a room with you.
Well, hi, Lillian. How's it going?
It's going so good. How are you?
I'm also very good. Thank you. But before we dive into our episode today, I have a very important question to kick everything off.
Okay.
So this is also relevant to what we will be discussing. So if you will, please indulge me. I and our listeners need to know, do you have dry hair, oily hair, or normal hair? How would you describe your hair?
So it's tough because I often struggle with dry hair, but like recently I chopped all of my hair off, like a solid foot and a half of hair off this week.
And it's very cute.
And then it can tend to get more oily. And I just wish there was some way that, because my hair, many things, never normal. And I wish that there was like a product I could switch between when my hair is dry or oily, you know?
I know. Yeah, well, lucky for us, the sponsor of this week's version that we watched had products for all kinds of hair types. I would say I have normal hair because I'm a normal person. That just killed me every time they said that. And I was just like, normal? You guys are mean.
Instead of like average, which feels like, okay, so it's like somewhere in between. It's like you're either dry, oily, or you could be like normal fucking people.
She's like, okay, guys. Also, their like hair all looked exactly the same, but I guess that's the point. Is they're like, oh, use our products, and it's all balanced out. But
so if people want to know what this product is, because maybe we just keep the name of it to ourselves, what adaption of Jane Eyre do they have to watch to learn this cool information, Piper?
Well, if you go on to, at least here in the United States, if you go on to Amazon Prime, you now have access, just like we do, to, it's the 1961, is that right? 1961, made for TV movie. I think it's called like Family Classics.
Yeah.
Was the like hour where they like put this on through. But it was sponsored by a line of beauty products and hair products.
Yes.
And every single commercial had an ad for that, which apart from the like funny terminology that they used, I was delighted because I watch a lot of YouTube content creators who do kind of like retro, like hairstyling and fashion design and stuff. And so it's always interesting to see like what techniques and products they use to get those like old timey looks. And these are like the perfectly coiffed kind of like 50s housewife styles that they're kind of showing off in these ads. So it was cool to see them talk about it.
Yeah, I liked that. I also was so glad because this is our third TV movie we've watched. They always have the commercials. Genuinely the joy that I get watching these with the old commercials. And I was like, well, this, it's not like a weird stolen copy that we have of it. So it's not going to have the fun old-timey commercials. And then they immediately started with the sponsors. And I was like, yes, this is the dream.
Amazing. But yeah, Lillian, tell us a bit more about what version. This is 1961. What
yeah, so fun. So here's some fun facts about it. It was originally up until the last few months. Like, I don't know when exactly it went on to Amazon, but I can tell you that I looked at it at the beginning of the year and could not find it. And it was a listener who let us know that it's up on Amazon now. So it was originally in film archives in LA and New York, but now it is available via the internet. Did you recognize the woman who did the announcement at the very beginning of this adaptation?
Her name was familiar. I know that she's like a famous actress from that time, but I couldn't think of like what she's from.
Joan Fontaine, who our more eagle-eared listeners will know, played Jane Eyre in 1943.
Oh, cute. That's a fun throwback. That's
awesome. I know. It was so exciting. I also will say another note on the sponsors before I do a recap of, you know, the movie we watched. is that I think of our three sponsors, they mm-hmm. one of them was beer. Mm-hmm. One of them was appliances, and the other one was like
hair home products. Christian values.
Yeah, that was one of the radio adaptions.
And the act of praying.
The radio adaptions really wanted us to pray. I think this was the best, like the most fitting sponsor.
Yeah, no, I agree. Yeah. I think because you can go from watching Jane Eyre with her perfectly coiffed hair mm-hmm. and be like, man, I wish I looked like that governess in the 1600s. And then they're like, guess what? You could look like the actress who plays her if you buy these products.
Incredible. Okay, Piper, we figured out before we started recording that I have to do the recap. So I would like to apologize in advance, but here we go.
Okay, hang on. Let me get my stopwatch ready. Okay, I am ready.
A woman who is an orphan shows up at a house, and she meets the someone named Mrs. Fairfax there and quickly learns that her boss is never around. Then she gets a tour of this beautiful house and goes downstairs a few days later and is looking at a book. And surprise, there's a man in a chair. Very spooky, scary. It's her boss. He is rude to her quite a bit. Pretty frequently rude to her. And her reaction to that, the normal reaction, fall in love. So they fall in love very, very fast after like six conversations over the span of 35 seconds. Then they get married and then there's a weird attack in the middle of the night. And there's a fire and there's all sorts of weird things happening. But that's not really something we need to worry about. So then he's mean to her again, but obviously that's what made her fall in love with him. So she agrees to marry him. They end up at the wedding. The guy who got attacked comes in and goes, hey, he's married, so you can't do this. and then after that, she goes, uh-oh, and she leaves. And then the most awkward man on earth asks her to marry him. And then a mad woman burns down a house in the best possible way. And she goes back to the guy who was mean to her. And he's blind now, but she loves him anyway. And they're happy forever.
1 minute, 30 seconds.
It was slow and bad.
No, it was not as bad as some of these other ones, you know?
Yeah.
I think you did a really good job in the beginning of like doing basic summarizing. So
thank you.
Nice.
I just lost the plot there a little bit.
Well, okay. I don't blame you though, because one of the things that really stood out to me about this is this version is like there was hardly any lines that felt like they actually came from the novel. This was very much whoever adapted this kind of wrote all new dialogue. They changed a lot of the stuff around like time-wise and kind of combined some scenes, which is something we see kind of frequently when we're doing these sort of like TV movies, mm-hmm. like because they have, you know, a shorter amount of time to do stuff. So they cut out big chunks. Like we didn't have the, you know, childhood, which we're usually okay with because that's sad and we don't want to see it. But then, yeah, like they just kind of like squished some stuff together and rearranged some things. Like the biggest one is that in my mind is that, the whole thing where like he first arrives and like gives the cadeau to Adele, that doesn't happen until after he like goes back and decides he's going to start doing this whole scheme with Miss Ingram, which wasn't even like she was there at the house for a party before that even plan came into motion. Uh-huh. And then he later comes back with her and then he's like, oh yeah, now I'm going to like do that whole give a present to Adele and tease and all that kind of stuff. So there's stuff that's like switched around and kind of mushed, but it was interesting.
I think it was so interesting, and I'm so glad that we watched this. I lied earlier. We've actually watched four TV adaptions. Mm-hmm. We've watched the 1949 with Charlton Heston, one of Amazing. My favorite movies of all time. then the 1952, which was frankly forgettable.
Yep.
the 1957, which was our first bad adaption we watched, like truly awful adaption.
That's Drunk Assault on the Stairs.
Yep. Assault on the Stairs will always have a special place in my heart. That is also the only one in color. Mm-hmm. And then the fourth one being this 1961 adaptation that we just watched. And I think of those four, it has elements that feel similar to all the other ones. Because Jane Eyre, they're setting themselves up for an impossible task. You cannot tell the story of Jane Eyre in an hour. There's just no way to do it. There's no mm-hmm. way to do it truly well. Mm-hmm. And I think, especially when you compare this to the 59 and the 52, this has significantly more sets. I think it even has more sets than the 57. Mm-hmm. And it also hits more of the plot beats than mm-hmm. any of those do.
Yeah.
The biggest difference, I would say, is what you pointed out in the dialogue, mm-hmm. in that particularly the 49 and the 52, we saw a lot of like Jane Eyre monologues mm-hmm. sliced in the middle of other pieces.
Yeah.
Where this one went more with, let's actually have a fire, let's actually have Mason show up and not just weirdly be a cartoon villain for a minute, like in the middle of a party fall down the stairs. That's what he did in 57. Like, so I think plot wise, it's a lot truer to the book, but dialogue wise, it's probably the least true to the book, which is really interesting.
It is. And I was like, especially noting, I went back this morning and I rewatched the scene where he does his stay speech, because I'm like, that obviously is one of the keystones of this whole story, and a lot hinges on that. And that, again, it really stood out to me how the dialogue was all completely original. But it was very interesting, like, what the writer decided to kind of, like, focus on, which I'm going to just put a pin in that, because I feel like we should kind of do, like, a beginning to end sort of talk through of this.
Yeah.
But just keep that in mind, because we'll go back to that later. But, yeah, she shows up at the door, and it's one of the most, like, unfriendly and cozy Mrs. Fairfaxes we've seen. She's kind of grumpy, this lady that greets her. Yeah. It's, like, such an inconvenience. That's what my notes say, too. Such an inconvenience that I have to like escort you to your room in the middle of the night, even though I'm just talking about how lonely I am and you are now my one companion. So,
yeah. And then she keeps being like, she does a lot of like weird, this Mrs. Fairfax knows, she 100% knows, which will be true for everything else shortly as well. But she's just immediately like, and it's awfully big for just us and the others. And then Jane's like, what? What are you? That was what? Super. I do like that this Jane, like every time somebody says something super weird, goes, what the hell was that?
Yeah.
She like, just out loud like, goes, do. What do you mean others? And she goes, oh, just the servants.
Yeah. And then like right afterwards, we see Grace Poole show up and go and like grab a giant bottle of gin from like the cupboard to be like, it's going to be a long night.
Which, by the way, so I have cast facts on most of these people, but did you recognize the voice of Grace Poole?
No.
She played the grandma in the Rugrats.
Oh, funny. I didn't really grow up with that show, so that doesn't really ring a bell for me, but I like knowing that. That's awesome.
There's a quick other cast fact, too, just right up top, because I think she's the best part of this adaption, and I'm going to be talking about that a lot. So Jane was Sally Ann Howes. Did you recognize her?
No, I did not.
Okay, this is a movie I'm not as familiar with, but it feels like a Piper movie. Mm-hmm. She was the female lead in Chitty Chitty Bang Bang.
Oh, okay. That is like tickling the back of my brain. Yeah. I saw that movie a couple of times when I was little. But yeah, that was mostly when I was at like a daycare, they would like throw it on or something. I didn't own that one.
I thought she did an incredible job, and of our TV movie Janes, by far the best.
Oh yes. She, like you said, she like asks a lot of follow-up questions. She's not a dummy. I really liked how they did kind of give her that sort of Jane strength, which I think he mentions that at the end when she comes back and she's being defiant and he's like, that's the Jane I know. And normally a version will say that and we're like, what are you talking about? She's just been a mouse who stands there this whole time. But this Jane like had personality and, you know, carried her own. She put out her own fire, which is always a plus.
Mm-hmm.
So
I want to talk about the fire scene more as well, but we have to talk about the Rochester showing up scene, because we've seen the TV adaptions try a lot of different things. Just to recap what they've done, they didn't bother making it weird. They just had her introduced to Rochester in 49. Mm-hmm. 52 and 57, there was a horse off screen, which is so funny.
Just like horse sound effects, like coconuts getting clapped together.
57 will continue to be one of my favorites, because in that one, she like helps him off to the castle they don't go get the horse. He just literally, like, the help me to the horse becomes help me home.
Yeah, just, like, carries him the whole way. Amazing. It's a good long time to really get to know one another. Mm-hmm. Character development off screen. But yes, in this one, so also to set the groundwork, Jane, like, one of the first things that she asks Fairfax when she arrives is she inquires about Mr. Rochester. So they don't do the whole, like, oh, I thought you were the lady of the house, blah, blah, blah. She's like, nope, I know who my employer is. I just don't know what he looks like. So that way when she goes down to, like, read a book one day and he's just sitting in a chair and he's like, aboo. Oh, sorry. I also like books. Hi, I'm your boss. And she's like, oh, my God. We're ready to start, but hi.
There's the vibe of that. Yeah. I wrote, he said, the line that he wrote down, first of all, he has such intense vampire vibes for that scene. And he should join. I was trying to remember who the other character, it was 73 St. John, and then we had another vampire that I can't remember who the other vampire was.
Probably a broccoli. There's been a couple of vamp broccolis.
That's true. There's been a couple of vamp broccolis. but he should join them. And he's like, the second thing he says to her was, I frightened you. I frighten most people. And I'm like, dude.
This is a very dramatic Rochester. I think the main thing that stands out to me, because I kept trying to be like, what does his voice and speech pattern remind me of? Because he does this very, like, intense kind of diction, and then he talks very fast and kind of then has slow, like, contemplative pauses. He's giving me Captain Kirk from the original Star Trek series vibes. And you can take that as you want. You could say that's very hammy and over the top, or you could say there's a lot of intensity and, like, purpose in that. So whatever you want to read to that description of how this man sounds.
Yeah, he was so intense in everything that he did, which in some ways is, like, that is an interpretation of a Rochester. I think it was hard because you could tell the pacing, especially at the beginning, they are just plowing through it.
Yes.
Because they give Jane's backstory really quickly. They go, she's just an orphan. Just like, don't. She's don't worry just about an orphan. Like, we can't go into the details. She was an orphan. I do think the person who adapted this did read Jane Eyre, which I have not felt about the other ones.
Amazing.
I think that it's interesting to watch that, because I do think Jane wasn't as wilting. That's the biggest redeeming thing about this adaption is the Jane, because she stands up the way that Jane would stand up. She banters back. I wish I had seen a little bit more of Rochester actually liking that.
Right.
Which felt like a pacing choice to try to fit it in the hour, but.
Totally. No, he does for a lot of the initial scenes, which this some a lot of versions do this where they don't make Rochester fall in love with Jane until she saves his life from the fire. But I think in the novel and in the versions that do it well, in my opinion, it's kind of like a love at first sight from that moment on the road. And like every moment after is him being intrigued. And so, yeah, this definitely felt a bit more like this. He was, you know, angry to be home. He hates this place. And now there's this girl here taking his books without asking. Although they did do a art scene, which I was also appreciative of. And they like let us see the paintings. So he's like intrigued by that, but he's very dismissive about like her answers. Like he asks a lot of questions, but doesn't really seem to listen. He's just like, all right, next question. All right, but next question. But like, you must be super depressed, right? Are you like really depressed? I'm depressed. And your art makes me think that you're also depressed. So maybe we're depression buddies.
And that's the hard thing. It's like, I wish that this one had more time with the exception of only one character. And that's Adele. Honey, she tried.
She tried very hard.
She spoke French in a very American accent.
Yes, she did. I also have to say real quick about this like meeting scene. I think one of the best parts though is when she's going up the stairs and there's a very obvious like woman scream sound and she stops and she, instead of being like, what the fuck was that? She just asks, did you hear that? And it feels like the scene in Elf where after he like belches for 5 minutes and goes, did you hear that? And they're like, yes. But Rochester's response is, it's just the wind in the chimneys.
He heard, I heard the wind in the chimneys. And she just kind of goes, I mean, no.
um, So the other thing that I want to address right away, because the movie also addressed this right away, is there's like, I think it's after the fire scene, which also they like give us pretty soon after this, mm-hmm. where he like straight up acknowledges that it's not Grace Poole. It is like a mad woman that he's caring for that is in the house.
It's after the Mason scene. So they're pretty quick back to back. But okay. It goes fire scene, and then we see him acknowledge it's not Grace Poole, but he still tries to pretend it's him. Okay. He's like, oh, I was smoking and that's what happened. And she's like, I love that she never believes him.
Right.
I love
that she's very so skeptical. She's like, she's like, I know you're lying to me.
I'm not
still
pushing
into
you
it.
Because I just work here, but like, yeah. We both know that this is a lie, right?
Okay, so then I will save those notes for later then. So let's, we get a fire scene.
Yes.
She which saves him all by herself.
Which I think is also really well done mm-hmm. for a TV movie, because usually in the first two TV movies, I keep comparing them, but it's because that's what my mind is doing. And they're so much fun to watch, because it's impossible to compare this to like the miniseries or the mm-hmm. 2011 movie or something like that. Like that's unkind to compare right. to them.
We have to keep them in the same weight bracket for like boxing and stuff. You don't put exactly. the welterweight up against the heavyweight. Like that's just mean.
Exactly. So the fire scenes in the first two are just fully Bertha's out here lighting stuff on fire. And I mm-hmm. love it. Big fan. Love mm-hmm. a crazy Bertha. Love when we get to see her lighting stuff on fire, which we do get to see later. Mm-hmm. But the 57 was the one where it looked like they just had like a pie on fire that they set
the
on a bed.
Yeah. Bed pie.
Where this one, they have him. So similar to the other ones where they have him in the living room, they have him sleeping on a couch, which I think does a better job of playing into his story of like, I was just smoking and then something caught on fire. Yeah. And then they have it be the curtains. But something that I really liked that they did that I don't know that we've seen any other adaption do is when she goes into the room, he's coughing and she mm-hmm. she puts out the fire herself. And then they go, we should get out of the room because there's a lot of smoke in here, mm-hmm. which both make sense as to why Jane is the one to put out the fire alone.
Yeah.
And why like Rochester, like it doesn't even acknowledge, like he's not awake. He's coughing. The smoke is the reason he can't get up. Mm-hmm. And he immediately goes, I am okay because Jane did something to yeah. Grace Poole, which is great.
Yeah. No, it's awesome. They go off into another room and that's kind of when they have like their kind of chat at first. And one thing that really surprised me about the scene too is that, because you know, normally obviously he's like, no, don't wake anybody, like what good would it do to go get Miss Fairfax, this is our little secret, I'm in love mm-hmm. with you now, feel the tension, we're in a bedroom and all this good stuff, but in this one, like the staff wakes up because why wouldn't yeah. they like hear all this shit that's going on, and mm-hmm. like as Rochester and Jane are having their kind of one-on-one in a separate space, Grace Poole and Mrs. Fairfax are in his that whatever room he was in, and they're like cleaning up the mess like right then and there.
Yeah.
And like they're talking about Bertha without talking about Bertha, and just yeah. like, so that one like again puts full forward, they're like, obviously Fairfax knows about this woman and she acknowledges it and the audience knows about it.
Yeah. And I think they also say an interesting line, which they give Grace, they put Grace in a lot of positions that I find significantly more interesting. Mm-hmm. This adaption posed a lot of questions for me that I think a lot of the adaptions, like they just great, like scroll past. And so you don't really think about, but like the relationship between Rochester and Grace mm-hmm. is one that I haven't thought about in a great deal of depth. And mm-hmm. I think it's really interesting to watch in this adaptation because Grace, for example, just straight up and down says, sometimes I wish it would. She clearly hates Bertha,
yeah,
which is a bummer. But there's a couple of moments, I think right after he meets Jane, she comes back in the, she comes in the room to get whiskey because, which we all know, Grace's drink is gin, so yeah. You guys could have done that, whatever. but she's talking to Rochester and he's like, I get it. I would drink if I were you. Like, who wouldn't? Which is a line from the book that actually the innkeeper says at the very end. But I think it's just interesting to see these moments. Like, how does Rochester react when Bertha gets out with the fire? And what is Grace's response when he goes, what the hell? And she goes, I have to sleep sometime.
Like, yeah, no, seriously. Valid. So this is more just kind of like talking about the idea of these characters, like in the book also, because I do think that's fascinating, is this idea. We kind of talked about this when we were going through the novel, that if you look at it from kind of the perspective of, you know, the Rochester is a caregiver kind of a thing. And when Jane again and again is like, why do you keep this person in your house? She thinks that Grace is the one doing all these things. And he kind of implies, like, apart from like a secrecy and a stubbornness, there's almost this sense of loyalty of him being like, what do you want me to do? She's worked for my family for a long time. I can't just throw her out because she's a little unstable. And it's like, if you go with that lie, it's interesting, right? That also like brings up curious questions about their relationship. It's not true to that extent, but it is this idea that, like, I don't think that he's close to Grace Poole in any way, but this is a woman that he's entrusted to watch over his wife. And he's like, no, she's got a very important job to do. I don't want to fucking do it, obviously. That's why I pay her. But also, like, I give her a big salary, more than the other staff. And, like, don't ask questions about this lady. She's doing a job that you don't need to know about.
But it also, I think, alludes to an idea that if Rochester was more invested in keeping the secret than doing right by the people that he takes care of, he would probably go find someone else.
Yeah.
Because he could fire her, say that's what it was, find somebody else, have them come in, just keep rotating that person out in order to keep the secret. And I'm not saying there's other flaws with that plan, but I think the loyalty to Grace holds true there too. There's another line that kind of comes back to that as well in this movie, which is when we see Fairfax and Grace Poole talking, and then we cut back to Rochester and Jane, and Rochester says to Jane to sort of dismiss any questions that she says, which is, I alone am responsible for what happened, which he's talking about, like, he's making up a lie about how he lit the curtains on fire with smoking, but he very clearly switches tone when he says, I alone am responsible for what happened. And I think he believes that. And I think that's an allusion to how I believe Rochester feels about all of it. Like, so much of his feelings about Bertha are guilt around the choices he made to get them to where they are.
I do really feel, I agree with you. I think that the person who adapted this, they understand the story. And I think they were doing a very interesting exploration of these characters with their significant changes. And I like that.
The next scene, I believe, is actually Jane and Blanche, which I just want to talk about really quickly.
Yes.
So he wants her to go to this party. She's not going to the party, which I think is an interesting way to quickly tell the same concept of a story. Like, if you have to cut out the, like, Rochester leaves and then he goes hangs out with Blanche and, like, all this stuff. Like, if you need to, like, condense that down, I think this is an interesting way to do that. And then Blanche coming out and being like, you left in the middle of my song. And then he doesn't even apologize. He's like, she's like, you asked me to sing a song and then you left, which is what happens in the book. And it's so funny to watch Blanche just be like, dude, what the hell?
Right.
And then for him to just straight up and down be like, I wanted to go find Jane. And then I didn't write down Jane's line, but she says something about Blanche, like, not finishing her education and how it's such a shame that she's, like, uneducated, which, like, what a sick burn.
Dude, seriously.
And then Rochester chokes. He's like taking a sip of his drink, and in the background he like chokes trying not to laugh at Blanche, which is so Rochester and so funny.
That's like probably one of their best like chemistry moments in this whole thing. And it's great to actually see Jane like kind of flexing what she does have. She's like, look, I'm not pretty, supposedly, and also I don't have wealth or stature, but at least I got an education, you dumb bitch.
which is what she's doing in her head the whole time. She's like, oh my God, you're so dumb. I can't even be in a room with you.
No, it's a very important scene. Thank you for bringing that up again. So then does, yes. Okay. So then Mason arrives and crashes the party. And this is the most like animated, confident Mason I've ever seen. Normally he arrives and he's like embarrassed to be there. And he's like, oh, I didn't realize I was interrupting. I just kind of needed to like check on my sister or whatever. But this one comes in, he like swings open the door and he's like, Rochester, who is this ravishing young lady? And he's like, leave her alone. She's mine. He's like, what the fuck are you doing here, Mason? I am working very hard to seduce this lady. Don't you dare swoop in and cock block me like the guy from that other TV movie who did it so well.
57 Mason will continue to be my favorite.
So good.
But this one is pretty good. The interesting thing, too, that they give this character that we haven't seen with others, which we also don't really see Rochester talking solely to Mason. Mm-hmm. So we don't know what that conversation is. So the only times we've seen it is in the adaptation. So this is making an assumption about why Mason is really there, because I do agree that like Mason sucks, like Dick Mason is like sucks, but all of the other adaptations sort of make this assumption that he sucks because he's so weak and sad, where this one makes the assumption that he sucks because there's some clause in the marriage contract that he can get money, but he has to get Bertha to agree to it. So he's there to get Bertha to agree to give him more money. And he's saying that he's there because he wants to check on her.
Right. So here they've given him more of kind of like a selfish, like kind of money grubbing, like kind of persona, which I do think feeds well into when Rochester is doing his stay speech and talking about how her family tricked him. We see by getting Richard's Mason. By seeing him like do these kind of things and like, you know, impose and also come to just like take money and go, I think it does lead more into being like, oh yeah, poor Rochester, like that sucks.
That does suck.
Am I remembering right that when Mason arrives and is talking to Edward, Jane is still in the room when he like alludes to this like marriage contract thing?
I think she may still be in the room, but she's like far enough away that I don't think we're supposed to think she can hear it.
Okay. Cause this is kind of the part where I'm like, they are really laying a lot of this on the table for Jane to pick up and kind of figure out, like, especially after the attack.
Well, and even Rochester's lie after the attack, I think even if she did hear it, he sort of gives an explanation. But yeah, I don't think she's supposed to be able to hear it. I think she's just supposed to be in the background, but I was watching her less than I was watching Dick dry his balls by the fire.
My God.
That's what he was doing. I don't know what to say to you.
Incredible. So he's all like cocky and he's like, I'm here for the money, dude. I'm just going to go up there, get her to sign some paperwork, and then I'm out. See ya. Yeah. And he's like, dude, don't do this. She's not okay right now. Don't go up there and talk to her. She's really violent at the moment. And he's like, it's fine. It's fine. She's my sister. It's cool. And he's like, okay, well, I'm not going to be responsible for whatever the fuck happens. And then, of course, attack. Yeah. Mauled.
And I like that only Jane, because they get rid of the idea that the party's staying there. So right. Jane just like runs down the hallway and was like, what happened?
Yeah. We did get a cute hand-holding scene of him being like, you know, are you afraid of blood? And she's like, I don't know. And he's like, take my hand just in case. Let's do this. And so that was nice.
And then I also really liked, this was another moment where Grace plays a bigger sort of different role than we've seen before. I like that Grace is there just being like, why did you do this to the same man? And just kind of being involved, because I think it makes it really interesting and compelling.
Yeah. So, because it's in this moment where they do like say to Jane, it's not supposed to be Grace Poole. There's like, yep, there is a crazy lady and she's in this house and Grace takes care of her and Mason is her brother.
Yeah.
But he like doesn't, the lie that Rochester tells Jane is that she was the wife of a family member of his.
Yeah.
And I'm like, that is so close to just revealing the truth without revealing the truth. And I feel like, go ahead.
No, I just think it really tells the story. So my favorite thing, I wrote down a couple of the lines from the scene. First of all, Grace says she has the strength of 10 when she's roused. Mm-hmm. And then Rochester, when they go downstairs, I was like, oh, like, so they're fully acknowledging there's another person here. And then Rochester just goes, well, now you know the mystery of Thornfield, which this is another one where they're like, there's a mystery at Thornfield, guys. and then the thing he specifically says is, the poor mad creature who was married to a family member of mine. And he mm-hmm. talks about the reason why he keeps her around is because he remembers how she was before, mm-hmm. which I think makes him so much more sympathetic.
Yeah.
When she learns the truth, mm-hmm. it's less jarring.
Yeah.
Because she knew something was there, and she knew that the reasons why he kept her, and like he does the whole explanation of not wanting to send her to a madhouse. Mm-hmm. So we don't have the entire, like the impact of like a chapter 27 stay mm-hmm. speech isn't quite as needed because we already have half of the story up front.
Which is a very interesting way to do it. It's mm-hmm. one of those things where when you talk about like, you know, creative adaptation and how it changes like the audience's perception, it's not the like authentic way, which like in the novel itself, it's meant to like really like challenge us to want to accept him. But if your goal is to be like, I want to make him more sympathetic and more likable, I think this is a good way to go about it of, yeah, laying that out a little ahead of time so then it's not all on him in that one moment, but then we can simply, when the truth is revealed and he's asking her to stay, it's more of him just kind of focusing on the two of them and being like, our love is more important than law and all this other stuff. I think it's also interesting that, so this is the scene I was kind of talking about before where they kind of combine a couple of moments. Well, this is one of the scenes where they do that. And in this one, Jane, when she like knows about this mad woman, she's very bold. And I love that she asks this straight up. She's like, is that Adele's mother? Like, and that's a great question to ask. Cause like, that's another place where your mind would go. And he's like, I can see you. He'd think that, but no, I did bang this one opera singer and I thought it was going to be great. And she said it was mine, but then she was unfaithful, but I still took care of the kid. See, I'm so nice.
mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that this is where like, this isn't a true adaptation in that like, it's not super faithful to the text of like the lines and all of that stuff. The plot happens in different orders, but it is a very faithful adaptation. Like that is the relationship that those two people have. That is, mm-hmm. that feels very Rochester. Mm-hmm. Jane's reaction feels very Jane. Like I think they're true. There has to be a level of understanding of Jane Eyre to adapt it in this way that mm-hmm. I really feel like this author had that the other TV ones didn't, because they do have more lines from Jane Eyre, but anybody can go copy paste a line from Jane Eyre
and have it not mean anything mm-hmm. if you don't build up the necessary emotional weight around it or understanding. Mm-hmm. So, okay. So then Rochester does this whole like very briefly trying to convince Jane that he's going to marry Blanche.
Well, first he leaves. So instead of having him leave after the fire, they have him mm-hmm. leave after the mason part, which is interesting.
Right.
There's a and really brief scene where Blanche is wearing an incredible hat.
Oh, I know. She looks – it actually reminded me a lot of the riding outfit that Blanche wears in the 80s miniseries.
Yeah.
Very similar.
Very great outfit. Big fan. So they did that, and then – that's the scene where Blanche like leaves. She's like, this is honestly weird, which fair. And she leaves. And then Rochester's like, I decided to come back because after my travels, I decided I wanted to get married. And that's where he like does the convince. And that whole scene is just like close, but no.
It's inside. It's on the stairs. Like, it's kind of him just very briefly being like, what if I married Blanche? How would that make you feel? And she's like, sad. And he's like, why? And she's like, you know why. And he's like, JK, what if I wanted to marry you? And she's like, happier? But I think you're lying to me.
Like, another moment right before that, right before when Blanche is leaving. I just remembered this from my notes. When Blanche is leaving, a maid comes in and says, your coach is here. Did you catch the name of that maid?
No.
Bessie.
Oh,
which was
cute.
Just such a fun, like, allusion to actual Bessie. But I thought that there was a lot of little things like that in this too, where it's like, I believe the people making this care about Jane Eyre.
Yeah, totally. So they do a real quick like switcheroo gotcha, and then he's like, yeah, marry me, and she's like, all right, and he does, you know, a kind of classic like grab and smooch, which is like very classic for the time. So we got that, and then we see Jane in a wedding dress, which I thought a cute detail was, is that the wedding dress was Rochester's mother's wedding dress.
Yeah.
And so when he gives her the veil, he's like, well, it means a lot to me that you're wearing my mom's wedding dress, but I wanted to give you something brand new that's all yours. Here's this really pretty veil, which is a very cute moment. Although I thought it was kind of funny because she's got this like hairstyle where she's got like this big kind of pomp, like waves going away from her face. Mm-hmm. And then like kind of like a pile of curls, like a hat on top of her head. Uh-huh. And so when she has the little, the veil, she just kind of goes like, just kind of like places it on top of that little pile of curls, and I'm like, tee, that looks kind of funny, but what can you do with that hairstyle? So,
let's talk about the wedding scene, because I have some feelings.
Yeah, my favorite part is that there's fists are thrown and a man bleeds. And I love so much. Okay, so classic stuff, you know, speak now, forever hold your peace. In comes Dick Mason, and he's all like, yo, they're married, blah, blah, blah. And Rochester fucking clocks him. He, like, punches him in the face. And the priest is like, dude, we're in a fucking church. Chill out. And it was really good.
This is the only TV movie adaptation that has a wedding in a church.
Mm-hmm.
It's the first two, they do it in his living room. And then the third one, the 57, they just skip it.
Yep.
But yeah, Rochester hitting Mason was so cathartic to me, because Rochester wants to hit Mason in every adaptation.
Yes.
Rochester wants to hit Mason so bad, and he rises above it every time. And it was really nice to see him not rise above it.
It's so good. And I love that even after Mason, this Mason is like nothing like these other timid, cowardly Masons. Because even after he gets like sucker punched by his brother-in-law, and then like he goes, Rochester goes to storm off to like prove that the person he's married to doesn't, shouldn't count. And Jane goes to go after him, and Richard grabs her by the arm, and he's got the wedding document. And he's like, look, I'm trying to save you from bigamy. Read this. And she's like, let go. Hang on, I have to go see what this guy's doing. And
the priest takes it, which I like.
Yeah.
The priest is like, I mean, she might not care, but I actually super do.
Yeah. So we go see Bertha, and like it's a room mm-hmm. filled with straw in like a tower, and you have to like duck through this tiny little door to like get into it, and she's very spooky and crazy looking.
And it's a real bummer of a Bertha. She gets her moment to shine a little bit later. But yeah, very, I think, frankly, kind of book accurate. And disappointing.
What is good about it, though, one detail. So she lunges at Rochester, classic. He kind of grapples mm-hmm. with her. But then Grace Poole's reaction is to, like, use what looks like a horse whip to start whipping at Bertha. And what Rochester shouts as he's, like, fighting Bertha off is he's like, don't beat her! Don't beat her! And it's just yeah. like, that's nice. Yeah. I feel like if it was a certain Syrian Kyrian Hines, he'd be like, Peter, do it! Like, save me! Wait, give me the thing and I'll do it! Like,
Kyrian Hines would, like, tie her up and be like, why didn't you beat her?
Yeah, seriously! So that's a bit of sympathy, which is okay. But she still gets hit and then, like, put down into the straw.
My favorite diversion of like not representative of the character in the book at all, but also so fucking funny.
Tell me.
St. John Rivers.
Oh, wait. Hang on. We have to talk about the stay speech real quick before we jump to St. John.
Oh, okay. Let's talk about the stay.
Okay. So he's waiting downstairs. He's like, Fairfax, have you seen her? And she's like, no, she hasn't come out of her room yet. And then Jane comes down and she's like, hey, Fairfax, can you call me a cab? I really need to get out of here. And she's like, oh, okay, bye. And he's like, no, you're not leaving. He's like, I love you too much. And so because we didn't have all of the like explanation stuff, we had mm-hmm. that before. Now it's just simply him being like, no, like, screw the laws of man. Like, yeah. Our love is worth more than that. There's a line that I should have written down, but I didn't. But he has this dialogue that I thought was really kind of cool. And he's like, we deserve the right to like live freely and love mm-hmm. truly to one another. It's like something like that. And I was like, that's nice. I think that captures kind of Rochester's kind of mindset and like philosophy about this kind of thing. So I liked those moments.
I also have a note here because you're reminding me. I just honestly forgot about this day's speech because I was so excited to talk about St. John.
the only time Lillian has been excited to talk about St. John.
The only time I ever will be. One of the things that she says to him, which again, like captures, I think, the idea of Jane Eyre, but not isn't remotely aligned from it, is like, if I don't stand by what I believe, I will be nothing. And yeah. then he goes into a whole speech about, you don't even understand what nothing is. I can tell you what having nothing is. And he's sort of saying, if you leave now, you'll have nothing. And having nothing will kill you in the way that it's been killing me.
Yeah, totally. Which I really like that. And I love, I think it kind of, in a similar way, again, I can't compare like a mountain to a molehill, but yeah. in a similar way to what I love in the George C. Scott, where a lot of it is him talking about, he's like, I have this like horrible emptiness inside of me because the woman that I want to be my wife and care for me is incapable mm-hmm. of giving me that. And you can fill that hole. And I'm asking you to maybe step into that role and help me. And I can then give you all my love in return. And I think that is equally kind of communicated in this stay speech, which I think is really sweet.
Yeah.
And sad.
That is nice. It is.
But he says he has enough love for both of them. And he has a couple more like forcey, grabby kisses. And yeah. then she's like, okay, my taxi's here. I gotta go, bye.
Which is great. And then can we please talk about St. John now?
Yes, talk about St. John, so, Lillian.
St. John is cut in with Bertha burning down Thornfield. But mm-hmm. I want to talk about that next. I want to talk about all of the St. John scenes. Because we don't see her out on the moors. We just sort of get this quick little recap of like, I found a job teaching. And then the saddest, baldest, largest man walks into the room and I'm like, oh my God, is this supposed to be St. John? And then she calls him Mr. Rivers and he's like very sad and awkward. He has deeply like nice guy vibes where he's mm-hmm. like, nice guys always finish last, which is so funny because it's the opposite of St. John. Like yes. St. John in life is like, I'm too beautiful for words. But in this adaptation, in life, in the book,
but how he exists in our hearts and our minds.
Terrible but hot.
Where this guy's like sweet and like unfortunate looking.
Sweet, but like so awkward, and he gives you the really creepy like, don't leave your drink unattended around him vibes.
Oh, I didn't get that vibe.
I got those vibes from him so hard. But very, I just like almost incel-y.
What I just kept laughing about is like seeing this actor, with no offense to this man, because he's just like an average looking dude who's just like a bald kind of like overweight guy. But I'm just like, okay, but like in the books, St. John is supposed to be described as like a Roman statue and like the picturesque like male physique. And I'm like, ooh, look at this ideal man walking into the classroom.
And then my favorite. So he does propose to Jane, mm-hmm. which they do it really interestingly because she just thinks he's offering her a job. She's like, oh my God, do you think I would love to do that? That sounds like a great job. Like, you think I could do that? And he's like, well, I mean, obviously we'd have to like set an example.
Like, if you know what I mean. And like, she's like, oh, I guess I know what you mean. And I guess I'm okay with it. And then he leaves and she's like, yeah, never.
She's let me think about it. And then the thing she says out loud, so he like leaves being like, maybe I'm going to get married. And then out loud to an empty room, she says, Mr. St. John Rivers, no.
No.
Never. Never.
It is very, very good.
It's so funny.
Oh my gosh. So good. And yes, this guy felt like such a cartoon and such a caricature, especially the way that he talked. It was very like Cogsworth, but like more desperate and sad. So she goes to the window and she hears Rochester's voice. And she's like, I heard that voice all the time, but this time it feels different somehow. So then we get the house burning.
The house burning does happen sort of in between.
Right.
So
right.
The house burns down and then we see this terrible proposal.
Yes.
I loved this house burning down scene. Big fan.
Well, first of all, they had like such a fire budget. There was so much flame. Uh-huh. And they moved from many different like scenes and locations as she's like running through and burning the house. It doesn't just feel like she burns like one room. It feels like she like burns this whole damn place. Yeah. And I love like the hallways were so smoky and I'm like, how are these actors not coughing their lungs out?
They were. It was before we cared whether actors lived or died.
Oh my gosh. But she like, so she's running around with the torch and Grace tries to like tell her to put it down and like give it to her. And she's like, and she like runs away. And then she's like also confronted by Rochester and he's all like, he's like, give me the torch. Give it to me. Like she's a dog. And she's just like, and like throws it at him and like hightails it for the roof. And it's like, he tries so hard and it definitely doesn't feel like it's like an inconvenience. And he's like, awful thing that I have to wrangle because you're burning my stuff. It honestly does feel where he's like, come on, like, don't do this. Like, let's get you back to your straw room.
And it, especially since like, there's so many pieces of that I found really interesting. And it's always interesting to watch a Bertha burning Thornfield scene because we don't get it actually in the book. Mm-hmm. But I think that would, I mean, like, obviously this household is all pretty active. So the idea that all these people are like, don't do it. And she's like, like running through them, like bobbing and weaving through the people try to stop her.
She's an ultimate quarterback. Take it home. Touchdown. Touchdown for Bertha.
And she's just like lighting drapes on fire as she walks past them. It's so well done. And then the scene of her on the roof, like, it's actually pretty heartbreaking to watch and be like, please just come inside. Like, let's just go inside. It's going to be okay. Like, don't do what you're doing. Mm-hmm. And then it reminded me so much of our conversation we had last week when we were talking about Thornfield and Bertha, instead of burning with the rest of the house, launching herself away from this to her own freedom. Like, yeah. I really think they captured that concept.
Totally. And they had two big fireball explosions, like right as she went, like once when she went over and then also as he's kind of running over to look down and be like, no, and then another big fireball. So
they spent their money where it belonged.
Yeah, it was very epic. So then Jane goes and finds him in his little new abode and he's very grumpy. And he's all like, I'm blind. You came to see what you wanted to see. Gawk at me, the freak. Now go. And she's like, he's silly. You're not even ugly. You're just staring into the middle distance.
They also have a really interesting conversation to me because he does, as you pointed out earlier, he is really grateful when she actually like starts talking back to him and isn't like just telling him what he wants to hear and being, I'm sure everyone started speaking really softly to him, which would be so jarring if you were Rochester.
Yeah.
And I think in general, they do a really good job, but there's a line in particular that I, again, like it's that allusion to something in the book, if you know the book as well as we do, which is there's a line where he says, I don't want your pity. And she said, it's not pity that I feel. And I think it's interesting because that's distinctly not what Rochester says in the book, right? He says he wants Jane's pity because he knows how that's different from other people's pity. But I think Jane instead is reframing the feeling she's having as not what we would think of as pity, but like just a different, I think it captures that same idea in a really different way, the same way that we've seen in a lot of the rest of this movie.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Because otherwise, there's kind of more of a moment where she's like kind of teasing him back. It's sort of like mini revenge. They don't do that in this one. But I do kind of like it sometimes when it happens because it's like, yeah, you do kind of deserve that. Of her being like, oh, no, I'm just going to be your neighbor and your nurse and your friend. And he's like, damn it, I want to kiss, though. And she's like, maybe. But yeah, no, this one is just her being like, no, it's not pity. It's sympathetic affection because I love you and I came back for you. So. And now you're single, so.
So I have a few cast facts. One that's The first one I have is kind of a bummer, which is the actor who played Rochester died like not too long after this movie came out, so he was not in much.
Oh, poor Fritz. His name was Fritz. And I was like expecting kind of a German accent, but he's just a man named Fritz.
Just a man named Fritz. The actor Fritz. Who played Mason was in a ton of movies in the 70s. He was in a lot of like horror movies and action movies in the 70s. Cool. His name was Zachary Scott. Mm-hmm. And I think he was also smaller parts in later movies, but he was like the star of a lot of action movies shortly after this movie.
They gave him a special guest star title at the beginning.
Mm-hmm. And then we already talked about the actress who played Jane. She was 30 years old in this movie, which she didn't. She looked older than our average Janes, but she did not look 30 to me. Mm-hmm. Although I guess we're almost 30, so maybe my idea of 30 is just off now. and then the actor who played Rochester was 47. So a little on the, I think their age gap stays about the same, but they're both aged up a bit. Mm-hmm. The actress who played Grace Poole was also, she was the one who I said was in Rugrats. She was also the neighbor in As Good As It Gets. So that's a great movie that she was in. Cool. The actress who played Adele was so terrible. It's not her fault. She was a child. She was an actual child. She was 9 years old. And she was in a few things as a child actress. But otherwise, those were really the actors who were in things beyond just these TV movie casts that we've talked about quite a bit.
Cool.
Quick little bonnet watch also. Great bonnets in this. In general, the costumes were really good for a TV movie.
Yeah.
Blanche's hat was incredible.
Loved that. Stole the show. He didn't feel for a, I guess it's 60s. The 70s adaptations are the ones where they always slip in their weird ruffled shirts. So I was going to say this didn't feel too much like the time period kind of leaking into the adaptation. But also the style then was kind of more just like, you know, jackets and suits and stuff like that. So there's not much big style things to kind of stand out.
This one felt a little bit less. The other ones feel like they're churning out classic movies, like telling these, retelling these stories as quickly as they can with recycling whatever they can, like low budgets. Nobody involved in making it really loves Jane Eyre. This felt more like people involved in making this love Jane Eyre, which I liked.
Totally.
It was really fun. I know we talked about it a little at the beginning, but like it was so fun seeing Joan Fontaine right at the beginning and being like, look at you.
That's awesome. I did not clock that, the association to it. I just, when they said her name, I was like, I know that's a famous person, but I can't tell you why.
I know. I had the same moment and I was like, I know that was a Jane, but which Jane was it? Because I do all our hashtags and stuff on our social. So I was like, which Jane was that? And I was like, it couldn't possibly be. What a celebrity. But I don't know if she was involved. I didn't think to look up if she was involved in all of the family theater or if they brought her on just for this. But that is what we have here. Let's do our ratings and then let's talk about next week.
Awesome. You go first because I think I did the last one first.
Okay, fine. I am absolutely grading this in comparison to the other TV movies. If I was just talking about how much fun I had watching this, it would be significantly higher because we have not gotten to watch a full Jane Eyre adaptation in English that's just fun for me in a long time. Mm-hmm. But I think my most honest is 7 out of 10 Sally Howes.
Sally Howes?
Howes? That's the name of the actress who played Jane.
Okay, cool. I was like, what are you saying? Because
she was
right
the
now?
Best part of this by a long Piper just deeply confused.
I'm like, what are these words?
She cool. was incredible. She is she is by far the best TV Jane we've seen, other than the miniseries.
I agree. So 7 out of 10 for you?
Mm-hmm.
I'm gonna give this it was gonna be a 7 for me. I think I'm gonna bump it up to a 7.5 since I really enjoyed our dialogue and it definitely occurred to me more like how much I think the person who wrote it cared for the source material. So mine is a 7.5 torches.
Nice.
The kind that you would run with through a building as you're setting it ablaze.
Perfect. next week, I'm very excited for this. We found out about this about a few months ago. This is what happens with our schedule the way that it's been, is I got to spread things out so we're not just doing like Bronte stuff every other day. But when we watched one of the first Bronte documentary, this was one that came up, which there is a documentary called Bronte's and the BBC that is just about why the BBC has adapted so many Bronte classics, with Wuthering Heights and the one that Anne wrote.
For a second, I thought you were struggling to think of Jane Eyre, and I was like, come on, Lillian.
And Jane Eyre. I'm really excited to see that. So awesome. Thanks to the Jane Eyre Facebook group for that, because we pulled it from there.
Yay. That'll be great. So if you want to join us for that documentary and then hear our takes on why people love this so much, I mean, we've already kind of talked about that on our own, but now we're going to see what the BBC thinks. So in anticipation of that, follow us on social. You won't miss anything. We are at Airbuds. If you want to send us emails, I went through recently and responded to some of the ones from the Wuthering Heights episode. Love to hear your thoughts on that. That was so great. We are airbuds@gmail.com. So reach out anytime. Share your thoughts. If you've seen this one, if you are now jumping online right now to go watch it, it's free. Mine was like a rental that only cost like 0 cents, and then they're like, there might be a 10 cent processing fee, and I was like, okay, it's free, so great, go do it. We want to hear your thoughts too.
Yeah, I think technically it's 99 cents, and then if you buy it, it's $3, but I had digital credits. Ooh. So I bought it for $3, but it was really free because of my digital credits.
There you go.
But yeah, it's very fun to watch. If you listen to this podcast, you'd have fun watching it. Get some friends together for a roasty toasty time. but if you want to talk to us more often in a smaller group setting, and or you have decided to stop drinking coffee, but you don't know what to do with those three extra dollars that you have all the time, you're just kind of like, you've got all these extra dollars that are just sort of sitting around doing nothing. Here's how you can make those dollars work for you. This has become a finance advice podcast because that's what people need. give it to us. We love it. and you can do that with our Patreon. You can just give us the $3 and you can vote in polls and have a higher weight there. And see our lovely faces, like our listeners are seeing our faces right now who are already on Patreon. Hello, we love you all slightly equally, a little bit more if you are Bonnie, who is our Jane. And we wanted to thank you specifically. We thank you every single week because we love you so very much for being the best kind of person.
We love you.
But yeah, that's all.
So, guys, go watch that. Join in the fun. Talk to us online. Give us your money and your love. And we will see you next week on Airbuds. So happy Jane Eyre reading and watching. Goodbye.
Bye.